Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, Episode 9, 7 Cooking Myths Exposed. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the show that's dedicated to helping aspiring home cooks grow their skills and confidence in the kitchen so they can start cooking up memories with family and friends. Well, almost didn't get an episode recorded tonight because as I was just setting up, I have my recording desk and all my equipment, and I keep a glass of water sitting right beside me, and I just started recording, and for some reason I felt the need to reach out and grab a pen that was sitting on my desk. Well, for whatever reason, I was reaching right for that glass of water, and I knocked it over, and water went everywhere on my desk, and I had a moment of panic because I've got my iPad and my laptop, I've got my mixer, I've got all sorts of stuff sitting on the desk, and there's water everywhere. I had to run to the kitchen and grab some paper towels, but luckily the water only managed to destroy every piece of paper document on my desk and somehow missed all the electronics. So I'm here for take two, and I think I've got the water situation under control, so that's good. Hey, if you want to check out our website, by the way, you can do that at kitchencounterpodcast.com. There I post all of the show notes along with recipes and some other resources. And if you want to get to any of the show notes directly for this episode, you can go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/9. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. And of course on Twitter at @TKC Podcast. And finally, if you'd like to send me an email directly, if you have any questions for the show or want to provide some feedback, you can do that at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. So it is Tuesday, November 25th, 2014, 2 days before Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S. as I sit down to record this. And I didn't do a Thanksgiving episode this year. I talked a little bit about this in the last episode, but I kind of did that on purpose because I felt that there was already enough Thanksgiving information out there, and I just didn't want to be more of that noise. Although Thanksgiving, I should say, is my favorite holiday. I do love the cooking. I love the food. I love the family. I love all the stuff that goes along with Thanksgiving. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm not excited about Thanksgiving, because I am, but we're going to do something a little bit different for this episode. One of the memories along with food that I hold very dear in my family growing up, especially during the holidays, was we would play a lot of games. So before dinner, after dinner, all through the weekend, if family was around, chances are at some point, some sort of a game would break out, whether it was card games or board games or dice games, you name it, we played it. And I would say my family's pretty competitive. We all like to win, but more than that, it was just a lot of fun to play games and sit down and eat leftovers or dessert and break out the deck of cards and play some Pinochle or whatever with family after dinner. So today, what I thought I'd do, I had some topics that I wanted to talk about on the show, and I thought we would have a little bit of fun because you're my family here at the Kitchen Counter Podcast, and I thought we could play a little game together. So I originally was going to talk about some cooking myths, which I still am, but I was just going to kind of lay out the myth and kind of do some myth busting, if you will, down the road. But I thought maybe we'll do something different with these 7 ideas. And instead of me telling you right off the bat whether it's a myth or not, maybe we could play a little trivia true or false game. So if you feel like it, grab a piece of paper and you can keep score. So these are 7 ideas or topics or cooking lore, old cook's tales, as they're sometimes called, have been around a long time. And I've heard of all of these in one form or another. Some are certainly more popular and more prevalent than others. Before my research for this episode, there was even a couple that I still kind of thought were so. I'm not going to tell you which ones those were, but I bet in this list there are at least one, maybe more, that you might think are true or correct. So we're going to go down this list and we're going to talk about these 7 cooking myths. All right. First one. Are you ready? Okay. Here's the statement. You tell me, is it true or false? Bay leaves are poisonous if eaten. All right. Are bay leaves poisonous if you eat them? All right. Got your guess. All right. Here we go. Bay leaves are not poisonous if you eat them. So that one's false. That's a cooking myth that I know has been around for a long time. I don't remember when I first heard this one, but I was always told, or I was under the impression from whoever first told me, probably my mom or something, that you cannot eat bay leaves. And that's why when you cook with a bay leaf, and bay leaves are used a lot of times in stews or simmering sauces, that sort of a thing, you always remove the bay leaf from your dish before you serve it to people. Because if somebody were to get a hold of one of those and eat it, they could be killed because it was poisonous. Well, the good news is that's absolutely not true. Bay leaves, although there are several varieties of bay leaf that are sold for culinary uses, all of the ones that are sold for culinary uses are absolutely safe to eat, unless, of course, I suppose you're allergic. But as far as being poisonous, that's simply not true. Now, where did this myth originate? Well, I did some research, and it seems to me that because the bay leaf that we use for cooking has a very similar appearance and is kind of a distant relative to the leaf of the mountain laurel plant, which is quite poisonous and toxic to both humans and livestock, it's probable that there was a little bit of truth to the poisonous mountain laurel leaf and the bay leaf being conflated, and people just kind of assume that the bay leaf was poisonous as well. Now, just because bay leaves are not poisonous, before you get any grand ideas to throw a few in your salad or whatnot, I still recommend that you take bay leaves out of whatever it is you've cooked before you serve it, because even though they're not poisonous, if you've ever checked out a bay leaf, even after it's been simmering in liquid for a few hours, it stays kind of stiff and sharp, and if it's got a stem, it's kind of pokey. And while not poisonous, if somebody were to eat one of those, it could cause a choking problem. It could be a choking hazard. It can even, if they manage to swallow it, it can cause some stomach gastro problems because it's kind of sharp. So no, it's not poisonous, but yes, please take it out of the food before you cook it. And incidentally, in some cases, when you buy bay leaf in the store, it actually might come in really fine chopped up pieces, which if you put that in your food, in your recipes, of course, you don't need to remove all that. Those are fine to eat. And here's another interesting bit of trivia about bay leaves, especially for my friends on the west coast of the U.S. in Oregon and California. If you're out of bay leaves, you can actually use leaves from the Oregon myrtlewood tree, also known as the California bay laurel tree. They're actually quite closely related. And in fact, if you go look at a myrtlewood tree leaf, it looks just like a bay leaf. So you can actually use that in your recipe. They're quite a bit stronger than typical bay leaves. So just use less, smaller quantities, and you're good to go. All right. How are we doing so far? Everybody got the gist of this true false cooking myth thing. So let's go on to the next one. And it's a biggie. I probably should have saved this one for last, but oh well. So here it comes. Searing meat locks in the juices. All right. So does searing meat lock in the juices? So searing a steak, for example, does it make it juicier because it seals in the juices when you sear it? All right. Well, again, this one is false. It is not true. It is not true. Now, this one is probably the most common myth out there when it comes to cooking meat. I've heard over and over and over again that the reason you put a good sear on a piece of meat or a steak or whatever is that when it cooks, the juices won't be able to escape because you put that nice sear on it. It makes a nice crust and it'll be juicier in the end. Well, just not true, frankly. And when I think about this, I mean, think about it. If you have a steak or you have a piece of meat, how possible anyway would it be to sear every piece, corner, square inch of the surface of that meat so you could create some sort of a envelope where the juice couldn't escape? I mean, practically impossible. But really, it doesn't matter, because what does matter when it comes to the juiciness of meat is time and temperature, which affects so many things. So the longer you cook something and to higher temps, the drier it's going to turn out in the long run. Now, one thing that searing meat does do, and if your recipe calls for it, or if your cooking method can allow for it, you should always sear your meat because it causes what's called the Maillard reaction, which is a browning process when you brown meat or fowl or pork, or when bread cooks and bakes in the oven and it turns brown, it gets brown on top. That's the same thing. It's the Maillard reaction, and it actually adds tons of flavor and it develops flavor. So it's really worth doing anyway, even though technically it's not sealing in any juice. It's not doing that. It's just giving you a more flavorful crust and that browning reaction. Now, if you don't believe me, definitely Google this because there are some differing opinions on this. But in the show notes at kitchencounterpodcast.com/9, I have a link to an America Test Kitchen experiment where they tested a ribeye steak where they seared it first and seared it last in the cooking process. And they found that there was absolutely no difference in the amount of liquid in the steak. All right, that's two down. Let's move on. Next one on the cooking myth list. Warm water boils faster than cold water. So does warm water boil faster than cold water? You've probably heard something about this, but now you might be wondering which direction it's supposed to go. This is actually true. And intuitively, it seems like it should be true. If you start out with warm water, it should boil faster than cold water. But a common myth circulating kitchens around the country is that if you start out with cold water, it will actually come to a boil quicker than if you start out with warm or hot water. So if you're running your tap and you're filling your kettle of water, if you're running it full of cold water, the theory is when you put it on a heated element or your gas range, it's actually going to boil quicker. Simply not true. Warm water definitely boils faster than cold water. There's a reason that people might think this is not the case, that cold water actually does boil faster. And to not get completely nerdy and sciencey about it, when you start with cold water and you put it on a hot element, because the temperature difference is so extreme, heat exchange happens more rapidly. So cold water actually heats up quite quickly. But when it gets to the point where your hot water would have started, it will take the same amount of time to come to a boil. So really, when you start with cold water, you're just adding a minute or so, or depending on your oven, a few minutes onto that boiling time. Now, when I did research for this, interestingly, I did find there's some ideas out there that the reason a lot of the cold water, hot water myths started, maybe at the beginning they weren't necessarily a myth, but there was some practical application to it. And that's because in houses with older pipes that have lead pipes or lead fittings, when you run hot water through those pipes, apparently it can release more lead into the water than if you run cold water through the pipes. So back in the day, I guess people recommended that you cooked with cold water because you would have less or fewer lead particles in that water. So there could have been some reason behind that myth. All right, so three down. Have I irritated anybody yet because I've disabused you of a long-held cooking notion? Well, hopefully not, because we've got a few more good ones coming up. So let's hit the next one. We're on to number four, and that is alcohol completely cooks out of food. Is that true or false? When you cook with alcohol and you serve that dish, is there any alcohol left? So does alcohol completely cook out of food? This I told you at the beginning, I wouldn't tell you. This is one I didn't really realize that before I did the research for this, but that's false. In most cases, when you cook with alcohol, there will be alcohol left in the dish. In order to cook out alcohol, it has to cook for a long time, several hours to get all the alcohol out of a dish. And if you're talking about a dessert like a rum cake, where you know the cake is literally soaked in rum, of course, the rum cake is packed full of actual alcohol. Now, typically, when you're cooking with alcohol, there's not that much, and some of it will cook out during the process of whatever recipe you're cooking. So it's usually not a big deal. Like, for example, if you're making a risotto and you put a little white wine in at the beginning, that's going to be totally fine to serve to your kids. There's going to be practically no alcohol left. There will be some alcohol left in it, but it's not going to be much of a concern. I mentioned that it could be a concern because you might have guests or family that may avoid alcohol for dietary or allergen reasons, or they might avoid it for religious reasons. So just keep in mind that there will be alcohol left in your food after you cook it. Now, in the show notes, I've put a handy link to a chart that will show you, depending on how much alcohol you start with, method and time of cooking, how much you can expect to have left at the end of your cooking time. So it's kind of an interesting chart that you should go check out. All right. Well, we're going through these kind of quickly, but we've got a few more to get through. So let's move on to the next one. Now, this next one technically doesn't have anything to do with cooking, but it does have to do with something we find in kitchens a lot, and it has to do with coffee. So here it is. Avoid storing your coffee in the freezer to keep it tasting fresh. So should you avoid storing your coffee in the freezer to keep it tasting fresh? Well, this one is true. You should not store your coffee in the fridge or the freezer to keep it fresh. Now, this is one I've heard way back, and I know people that store their coffee in the freezer, and there are some differing opinions on this, but the consensus seems to be, and according to the U.S. National Coffee Association, which I would assume are kind of authorities on this subject, they say they you want to keep your coffee, whether it's already ground or whether it's in the whole bean form, you want to keep it away from excessive air, moisture, heat, and light, in that order. Now, while the freezer might take care of the air, heat, and light situation for the most part, I don't know if you've noticed, but freezers are really moist environments. In fact, even though everything in the freezer is basically frozen, if you've ever put, oh, let's say something in a Ziploc bag and you've thrown it in the freezer and you look a week later at that Ziploc bag and you notice there's all sorts of moisture and ice crystals that form in the bag because maybe you didn't get a good seal on it. That's because there's moisture in the freezer. So it's not a good practice to put your coffee in there because the coffee will absorb the moisture. Not only that, but surprisingly, freezers are kind of stinky places. And again, you wouldn't think that would be the case, but coffee really absorbs odors. And if you store it in the freezer and especially the fridge, it's really going to suck up the odors that are in there, and you may get a little funkiness with your coffee over time if you're storing it there. So where should you store your coffee? Well, again, according to the National Coffee Association, you should store your coffee in an airtight container in a dark, cool place away from any heat sources. So don't put it in the cabinet next to the oven, or don't put it in a cabinet that's exposed to direct sunlight, that sort of a thing. So store your coffee in an airtight container in a dark, cool place away from heat, and that is going to serve you best in the long run. All right, moving right along. We've got two left. Okay, here we go. Cooking food in the microwave destroys nutrients. So I bet you've heard this, and you're dying to know if it's true or not. Cooking food in the microwave destroys nutrients. Well, if you are a regular microwave user, you will be happy to hear that this is false. So microwaves, probably since they were invented and used by the general public, have kind of been scapegoats for a lot of stuff, both real and imagined. And it's long been said, and it's still said, and I've heard it before, that microwaving your food, especially like your vegetables, is going to destroy the nutrients in the food. Now, I think the reasoning behind this, I think why people say this, is they're assuming that the microwave is somehow irradiating the food, or it's using some sort of an unnatural process to cook that food. And I'll talk about that in a second. But the truth is, and let's just talk about vegetables because that's what I think of when I think of destroying nutrients, but I guess it could be any food, but we'll focus on veggies. When you expose vegetables to heat, depending on the intensity, the duration of the heat, water content, you're going to destroy some nutritional value. There's just no way around it. It can happen no matter what tool you use, whether you're using a microwave, whether you're steaming it on the stovetop, whether you're boiling your vegetables, whether you're cooking them in the oven. But interestingly, there's been some research that indicates that microwaving might actually turn out to be one of the best ways to retain nutrients in your vegetables when you cook them. So what do I mean by that? So if you prepare, let's say, broccoli, And you put that in a microwave safe container with a tight fitting lid and just a little bit of water in there. And you put that in the microwave for a couple of minutes. You're going to essentially steam that broccoli. And steaming is actually one of the best ways to retain nutrients in vegetables, because you're not boiling and washing away the water soluble vitamins that are in there, for example. So it actually can turn out to be a great way to cook your vegetables. Now, if you put that broccoli in the microwave in a bowl full of water and microwaved it until the water boiled, you're going to end up with the same result as if you boiled it on the stovetop, which is going to be a lower retention of nutrients. So you can actually get good results with vegetables in the microwave. Now, just quickly, and again, not to get too overly sciencey, but the charge against microwaves that it irradiates or nukes or makes your food radioactive and therefore less safe to eat, not true, luckily for us. So microwave radiation is non-ionizing radiation. And so what that means is the energy that microwaves put out don't have enough energy, at least the microwave ovens that we use, don't have enough energy to change the atomic makeup of your food. So it only has enough energy to excite the electrons, to speed them up, to make them heat up, and that's what heats your food. It doesn't have the energy of like an X-ray or a gamma ray. It's not going to irradiate your food. So it's certainly not destroying the nutritional value that way. And if you keep the liquid to a minimum, you're going to retain a lot of it in the microwave as well. So cooking food in the microwave does not necessarily destroy nutrients in your food. All right, we're on to the last one. Here we go. It's safe to eat pork that's been cooked to less than well done. So you go over to your friend's house, they serve you a pork chop that's not been cooked to well done. Should you eat it? Well, this one's kind of near and dear to my heart because I'm a pork lover, and I apologize to all my vegetarian friends who are listening, but by golly, I do love my bacon and my pork chops and my ham, and I could go on and on. But the good news here is that this is true. It is safe to cook and eat pork to less than well done. Now, a long time ago, pork had to be cooked to a dry, leathery state to be considered safe to eat, because there was this nasty little worm called Trichinella spiralis, which caused trichinosis. Now, this thrived in pigs, and it could be transferred to a person or animals if they ate undercooked pork. And these worms are nasty. They basically infect your guts, reproduce, burrow into your muscles. I mean, it's bad, bad. And obviously, you'd want to avoid that at all costs. Now, the good news is, if you're a pork eater, because of modern pig farming regulations and pork processing regulations, trichinosis is pretty much eradicated. I think there's single-digit cases a year reported to the CDC. And according to my research, it's not necessarily even because it was from pork consumption. But the good news is you can actually cook your pork to less than well done, so you end up with juicier pork. It's almost like cooking beef. And in fact, the USDA's newest guidelines say that you can cook whole muscle meat, including pork. So this would be like your pork loins, your pork chops, anything that's basically not ground or sausage. You can cook that to 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Then you let it rest for a few minutes and you're good to go. Now, they do recommend, and I recommend, that with any ground meats, like pork sausage, you should still cook to 160 degrees to be safe. But whole muscle meat, you no longer have to live with leathery, dry pork chops that you have to saw through to consume. So this is great news. So it is safe to cook pork less than well done. All right, let me recap if you're keeping score. We covered quickly 7 kitchen cooking myths. So first, bay leaves are not poisonous, so you can not have to worry about poisoning your guests if you use bay leaves. Second, searing meat does not seal in or lock in juices. So you're searing for other reasons. You're browning the meat, which adds flavor. Third, cold water does not boil faster than warm or hot water. Warm or hot water will always come to a boil more quickly than cold water, all things being equal. Next, we talked about alcohol and cooking in got to be careful because alcohol will not completely cook out of your food unless you're cooking your food for a long, long time. And most recipes are not going to have you cooking your food long enough to get rid of all of the alcohol. So take a look at the chart if you're concerned at all about this, which unless you have an allergy or you object on religious grounds, you shouldn't have to worry about this. But check out the chart in the show notes to see how much alcohol might be in your food. Next, we talked about storing your coffee, and you should not be storing your coffee in the fridge or freezer because that will impact its quality and flavor. So you should be storing it in a cool, dark place in an airtight container. Then I talked about cooking food in the microwave does not destroy nutrients. No need to worry about nuking or mutating or irradiating your food. That just simply doesn't happen in a microwave, completely safe to use. So go nuts with the microwave. And then finally, we just talked about pork, and contrary to conventional wisdom and the way they used to do it in the old days, you do not have to cook your pork until it's dry, flavorless, gray hunks of meat. So cook it at 145 and let it rest for a few minutes. Now, I've mentioned this before. The only way you're going to know if you've made it to 145, you can't do it by cutting in and looking at it. You do need to get yourself an instant read thermometer so you can check your meat. Okay, so those were our 7 cooking myths. I would love to hear how you did. If you disagree with me on any of these, or if you have any questions, or if I might do this again in a future episode, if you have a cooking myth of your own you'd like me to talk about, send me an email at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. All right, folks, so that does it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Thank you again so much for downloading and listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed this one. Again, if you have any other myths, send them my way. And if you do happen to get this prior to Thanksgiving, which it will be tight and you'll have to download it right away, I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday, full of good food, full of fun games, and I hope you're making some memories that you're all going to talk about years from now. And I've mentioned before on the show that if you're interested, you can head over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so you won't miss a single one. You can also do the same on Stitcher Radio. And if you're so inclined, at either place while you're there, you're more than welcome to leave me a review for the podcast. It does help where we show up in the listings and the search rankings so more people can find us and we can grow our Kitchen Counter Podcast family. Again, head over to the website, kitchencounterpodcast.com/9 for the show notes. Until next time, happy cooking.